Welcome back to the Preacher Podcast. We are at the fourth Sunday in Lent in our current series. We are basing our materials on the foundation from Wells Congregational Services. You can find more about our series, as always, at wellscongregationalservices.net. Click on the foundation, and you can find our current sermon series as well as the upcoming series that are planned. I'm John Mitchell from Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary. With me for this particular Lenten series, Pastor Caleb Kerbis from Erie, Colorado, and Pastor Aaron Getzinger from Attleboro, Massachusetts. Caleb and Aaron, good to be with you again. Aaron, could we start with you just giving preachers a reminder of this Sunday in our worship series?
The worship series is exactly what I need, and this Sunday we get to see our deep need for sight. Of course, we were born spiritually blind, and we have now been given spiritual sight, but at times we can kind of work with operating conditions as if we were blind. We fail to see dangers and particular temptations. We fail to see God's work and promises through His Word, which then causes us doubts. But Christ has come. He is the better servant who gives those who are blind sight and ability to hear. And he leads us, as we'll hear in Isaiah 42. So this gift of sight, this analogy, is a very wide-ranging analogy. And I think the readings will be really helpful to define what it actually is.
Thank you. Yeah, so exactly what I need sight this week. With that in mind, Caleb, can you remind preachers of what the gospel of the day for this Sunday is and also the second reading? And then we'll dive into the first reading as our sermon text. But reminders of the other readings, Caleb?
Yeah, the familiar account in John chapter 9, Jesus and his disciples encounter this blind man. There's that question, who sinned this man or his parents that he was born blind? It's kind of an ironic question because the question flows from a perspective of blindness, to be sure. And with this whole account, Jesus is really, and what we see are really two types of blindness. There's a physical blindness and the struggle and wrestling that people have to understand where this comes from and how, and thinking that's maybe the major deal. But what Jesus is really after, of course, is something far deeper and longer lasting, which is curing spiritual blindness in order to give eternal sight. It's no small detail that this occurs on the Sabbath. This accentuates certainly another aspect of blindness in the religious leaders, who have over their eyes this veil of religiosity and a blindfold of their own self-righteousness, which they think are the things that help make them see, and in as a matter of fact, are doing quite the opposite. So Jesus opens this man's eyes ultimately, though, so that he can see the real sight. And imagine this. The joy that this man would have as all of those physical anatomical things would be connected from his eyeball all the way to everything that needs to work to the brain for him to be able to see. And yet the greatest thing is the fixture of all sight, Jesus right in front of him, who's the light of the world. And then in Ephesians 5, no small matter is right after Ephesians 4, the working of the church, which makes us in Christ. Then now in chapter 5, we have the pivot of what this ought to look like as this in Christ aspect now becomes alive and visible and even bright in an otherwise dark world, as God calls us to be through his apostle, calls us to be imitators of Christ. He doesn't say that we are continually in darkness. He's talking to the new man in us, who has been brought into this new reality in Christ. We were in darkness, and now our lives ought to look much differently as we reflect the light of Christ. So we wake up compared to an otherwise sleepy, dreary, dark, dismal world, and we live out that bright baptismal reality that God has brought us into by his grace.
Thank you, Caleb. I'll just briefly mention too, Psalm 27 is the psalm appointed for this Sunday. The Lord is my light and my salvation. So, a very familiar psalm, very fitting with the imagery that is there in the other readings this week as well. Well, then let's go to our text, Isaiah 42, starting at verse 14. Aaron, could you give some comments on the text or the first part of it, however far you'd like to go, just to get preachers thinking about some pertinent aspects of the text as they form a sermon?
Yeah, I think it'll be worthwhile for preachers to go back and read the opening verses of Isaiah 42. They are pretty familiar. Matthew, of course, applies them to Jesus. He is the suffering servant. But one of the challenges in this section is grappling with the servants in these sections. So we'll have to grapple with that. Maybe just picking it up with verse 13, there you see Jesus. You see the Lord being described as a champion or as a warrior who is going to now wage war. And so suddenly there's a slight shift, and 14 picks up on that, and we get this picture of the Lord moving to action. So in 14, he describes himself as a pregnant woman. Maybe the question would be, why in the world is God acting like a pregnant woman? And primarily, it's because he had previously restrained himself, right? We get three verbs which describe that. It's rendered in different ways. NIV says, been silent, I have been speechless, I have restrained myself. And then you get another three verbs where I groan, I pant, I gasp together. And so, just as a pregnant woman can't keep back her groans or her panting or her gasping, so also the Lord now can no longer restrain himself from moving into action. And I suppose the question would be then, is this good action? Is this saving action, or it's destructive action? And you get to verse 15. And it is destructive action, right? You have him laying waste to the mountains and hills, and all of these fruit-bearing plants are being caused to wither up, and rivers are drying up. He says, I'll make them like the islands, and the marshes I will dry up. And so, right, this is God as creator showing his almighty power over creation, and we who are his creatures, who like to turn other created things into our idols, maybe we're gulping a little bit. Like, what is the Lord going to do now that he's coming to wage war and he's destroying mountains? Well, the problem is maybe, we might not know because we're blind. That's the next verse, right? I will lead the blind in a way they do not know. And there's a little relief here. Oh. So he's getting rid of the mountains, and he's getting rid of the hills, and he's getting rid of all of the forests and things that would impede him from coming to our aid. I will lead the blind in a way they do not know, and paths they do not know, I will cause them to march in. Right. And I suppose you could say, well, we do like to give credit where credit is due, and there are definitely people who cannot see, who are pretty self-sufficient. But I would have to imagine if you put an individual who was completely blind on a mountainside and said, now make your way down, that would be a death sentence to that individual, right? They don't know what is to their left or right. They don't know what's before them or after them. They would need somebody to come and lead them at best, or to give them sight itself. And then what does God do? These are the things I will do, and I will not forsake them. Remarkable, right? Because really, I mean, in some ways, this is a polemic against idols, right? God has already said, well, I'm the one who makes these promises and then delivers on them. Idols ever done that for you, right? Did idols take you out of Egypt? I have a pretty good track record with you people. All right, and so now we get to 17, has them consider their own trust in idols. And you have this maybe an implicit question there. What can idols really do for you? If the Lord is going to come and he's coming to wage war, can idols save you from the Lord? And and I'll just throw this out here as kind of an idea I had. There is a paragraph break at 17 in Hebrew. There's a paragraph break. And so maybe there's possibly just a good delineation right there if you want to preach a two-part sermon, a natural break in the text. And then moving on, 18 through 19, we're getting introduced to another servant. But first, God says, the deaf will hear and the blind will look to see. And I think there is some really cool gospel you could utilize. When God decrees something, it happens. Right? When God says something will happen, it is going to happen that way. And so we have a handful of, I maybe alluded to this before, we have a handful of servants here, right? There's the servant who is coming to the aid of God's people, the one that we heard about earlier in Isaiah 42. There's the servant of God who is about to be described, the one who is blind and who continues to resist. But then there's also these servants who, yeah, we are sinful, we are blind servants, but the servants who are delivered and becomes evidence of God's saving act, right? So we get that 19, who's blinder than my servants? Nobody. Who's more deaf than my servants? Nobody, right? That's kind of the gist in 19. And what makes these individuals deaf? It's their failure or their resistance, right, to what God's prophet has said. In the call of Isaiah and Isaiah 6, right, God says to Isaiah, go and tell this people, be ever hearing and never understanding. Like your message is only going to cause, they will reject what you have to say. And it's going to reveal where their hearts are at. And that's what light does. It both, as we heard in Ephesians and in John, it exposes as much as it also saves. And you see this wonderful example of it. And by the end, 21, you get this, like, I'm just envisioning this, right? If I were to visualize this in some way, right? This is the light portion. For the sake of God's own righteousness, he has made his law, his Torah, his instruction, his word great and glorious, right? And all of these things contained in there. Yes, it's great because it does inform my life, but it's also glorious because it imputes to me God's own righteousness. I'll stop there. I've been talking too much, I think.
No, not at all. That's great walkthrough of the text, and I think just what preachers are looking for as they try to sort through, as you noted, Aaron, the different imagery that's here, the different groups of people, the way that image of the blind person is applied and to whom it is applied here. So, Caleb, your thoughts on the text just in general, or we can feel free to start getting into kind of law gospel thoughts too, if you wish. But, Caleb?
Couple nuances. One of the things Aaron alluded to already, if he didn't mention it already clearly, is God gets borderline sarcastic in the previous chapter about the perspective of idolatry and like what are these going to do for you? And he's not done in doing this in thinking out loud for the sake of his people in order for them to understand just how blind and really stupid idolatry is. Because of what that does to the blindness, of course, of their heart. So for him, for that to be carried out, that just the context again of chapters 40 and 41 leading into 42 are huge. As a lot of this God's repetition and some of this, it would benefit the preacher just to double down on that, to kind of read through that as we think about how to build that context out in our own preaching. Some of the other things that he highlighted to these. This emphasis on God working himself. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Even at the outset of verse 14, these two hiphils and then the one hiphil, he is so leaning into in the driver's seat. The restraint that he has been practicing all along for himself. And I wonder, also Aaron said it rightly that when we think of verse 15, that he refers to himself as somebody who's going to give a woman who's going to give birth, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Well, he goes right into 15 and he says, I mean, he makes clear what that's like. Is there a little bit of an inference? I wouldn't say that this is a gospel verse, but is there a little bit of an inference for us to think about how God does ultimately carry out his ultimate justice, With the one, the ultimate servant lifted up on the cross, because there God's justice and his mercy do meet for us eternally. So is there an inference for that in speaking textual language that the preacher might consider? Maybe. I also noted just how when God is dealing with the blind, he just leaves no room in any of the verbiage for us to think in any way, shape, or form. Especially verse 16. This is what I'm going to do. You don't know. You not only can't see it, but you just don't even know. You die. You just can't see it. The gracious God who steps in from beginning to end leaves no room for otherwise wanton blind sinners to think that there's something they have to do, which very much, of course, ties in with the religious leaders in the gospel of the day and some of the preeminent blindness that they struggle with. Otherwise, no, Aaron was not talking too long, because he had more than covered my notes and then some. So, yes.
Can I just ask about one note? And you kind of alluded to this, Caleb. In the People's Bible, John Brown, commenting on these verses, notes that this is probably one of those sections, at least in the early verses of the text, where the kind of the coming of God or his breaking into the world is sort of the two phases come together. In other words, is this a hint at God breaking into the world through the servant he's been speaking of earlier in chapter 42, so Jesus coming, and also the final judgment, Jesus' first coming and Jesus' second coming, in other words, are they both alluded to here? There are places in the prophets where that's the case. I mean, like, a famous one is Joel, the Pentecost prophecy, where the prophecy is the New Testament era and the final judgment, you know, and Joel, looking from afar, kind of sees those together. Could we say this is a case of that phenomenon also, kind of first and second coming of Jesus being alluded to?
I think so. Just as it's probably important for just to maybe even think of the liturgical context, as the earlier part of chapter 42 is going to come up in Epiphany year A, so this same year, and there he's talking about, of course, bringing justice, and it's impossible to not talk about the ultimate servant here. Who is a servant? It's Jesus who's going to bring justice, and how is God ultimately going to carry that out? So. Is it a stretch in the context to think that here, now transitioning into verses 14 and 15, there is a convergence of these two phases? I think, specifically narrowly to the transition of 14 and 15, I like what Aaron said and how he said it. But also, like, for us in our day, as we look back with hindsight, unlike these original hearers, we get to see the way in which God carries that out. And I think there too, is there something that kind of points to the ultimate end as well? Second Peter 3 type of verbiage too. That stuff kind of comes to mind as well.
Yeah, that I think that might be helpful for preachers to consider as they're sorting through what's happening here. Let's talk law and gospel here. I know, Aaron, you said that you definitely get a feeling that this is a more law than gospel in these verses because of the justice that the Lord is bringing. How might you bring that into the lives of your hearers? Aaron, some thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, one of the challenges, I think, and maybe, Bible studies like the idols we never knew we had, it has been helpful with this kind of stuff. But even though I may realize the New England Patriots are an idol in my life, I don't think they're that big of, they're really like, I don't think people view it as, it's like place 1A or 1B, right? Okay, I'll leave God in 1A, but then Patriots are 1B, but God is still kind of in this superior position. But God doesn't want to share that number one spot with anything, right? And I think helping people kind of grapple with this idea of like God's really serious about not having any other gods and not turning created things into things that we think can rescue us from his wrath, right? I thought a little bit about the golden calf incident in Exodus 32 because it's I just read through it again and it was interesting. The calf is created and what's declared, these are the gods that have rescued you from Egypt. And then Aaron says, all right, we're going to get up the next day and have a festival to the Lord. And what do the people do? Like they engage in revelry and idol practices, right? So you kind of see this. They want to have it both ways. They want to feel like they're being faithful, but they also are getting tired of waiting for Moses to come down or God to come down or whatever to happen. And so they, and I think we can see ourselves in that. And that might be a helpful way to approach this. Like, what is vying for that 1B spot? Well, nothing should be there. It should be God 1A, God 1B, and that's it. And I think, of course, you could, the low hanging fruit for 21st century Americans are children's activities and things like that. But maybe just an encouragement to probe a little more deeply beyond some of the low hanging fruit. And maybe it's good to say, too, with verse 15, I think it's remarkable, too, that God takes his anger out on inanimate objects, not on the blind. If you want to view 15 as anger. I think you could take it two ways. It could be anger, but it could also be him clearing out everything between us and him in order that he might take on that work of providing sight and ears to hear.
Right.
So.
Yeah, or yeah, the law and condemnation delivered in mercy, right? Or with a merciful intent to right, clear things away, strip away our trust in idols so he can replace it with something that is far, far better. Right. Okay. So, picking up on the theme of idolatry there as law in the text. And God's judgment upon that, or the futility of trusting in those idols. Caleb, any further thoughts on the law in this text and in listeners' lives?
It seems like it's, and I kind of was thinking back and looking back at some previous times in Lent and viewing year A, just how this theme comes up with almost any of the readings. We've said how tight they are in previous recordings also, but like, just to what degree can our listeners see the malady that exists here? Like, it seems like there's this blindness before they can recognize their blindness. I mean, we've noted that in some of the other ones too, but just to double down on what Aaron alluded to already, like in verse 8, I will not give my glory to another or my praise to idols. Like God is dead serious about this. So it leads a preacher to think, like, how can I get my hearers to think of what's really at stake here in the ranking system of their own hearts and soul? And what is a misprioritization of the heart and soul actually going to implicit fail to give you that you think it's going to give you, whatever that is. So what would be the number one reason for chasing after these idols, and can you actually see that? And I think in addition to, if you bring up like to dig deeper than just kids' activities, of course, because one of the ironies, just to also double down on that, is you preached about kids' activities, and then everybody who's in the pews looks around and they see all of those parents who are gone at the weekends, and then they become equal to the Pharisees that Jesus is talking to in John chapter 9, which is kind of another idolatrous problem, right? So it's like, well, then how does a preacher kind of wrap their brains around this? What if it's just maybe a simple yet serious way of talking about the blind spots in our own hearts, like one of the other major idols or idol factories, like the protection of our time, like the ways that we talk about how we're busy, and whatever it is that we put in the place of the being alone with God and His Word. And it's beyond just worship, but like if you can see a person's life through their pocketbook, you can see a person's heart through their calendar, a wise old man once told me. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So what ways, and I don't have a perfect grasp on this myself. I would wrestle with this on, I think it would come pulpit time, but what ways can a preacher really double down on getting people to see the seriousness of idolatry in absolutely every single one of our hearts? There's a million ways to do that. I think perspective, aiming at helping my people to better see that, because in the more that we can see that, then the language of the first person language of God in this shines all the more brightly, as he's the one who steps in. Because the more I see, the more I realize, like, I can't escape this. And what can a blind person do to cause themselves to see better? And how can I even guide myself or lead, I can't, I don't know. I don't know. And they're the first person God shines all the more bright. I will do this for my own sake.
Right, Aaron.
Yeah, to that point of blind spots, right? I think maybe, and tying into that, a question that could be asked are what are the things that we somehow think are actually going to be of a benefit to us to rescue us from God's judgment, right? And there's all sorts of things that we can insert there, like I remember talking, just having a conversation with a friend of mine. Not a pastor friend. And just relaying to them the analogy or the little anecdote about Luther, I spend a couple hours in prayer every day because I just have too much to do otherwise. It's the only thing that will set me off on the right foot. And the person was like, "What? 2 hours? Are you kidding? Like, I don't have time for that." And like, I understand that's a lot of time, but also, is it a lot of time, or is that just my a blind area in my heart going, oh, these other things are really more important. I got to get them done. Yep, they are important. But there's only one thing that will rescue you in the end, and that is your Lord's instruction, your Lord's teaching, through which he gives you his own righteousness, right?
Great, great. Let's talk then about kind of the gospel that addresses those maladies that we've identified. We have said that maybe you, a preacher, wants to also go outside of the text, maybe to earlier in chapter 42 or something for more gospel, but suggestions for preaching the gospel from this text or its context. Caleb, some thoughts?
Verse 16 shines brightly, pun intended. Just, I will turn the darkness into light. Where you just think of how verse 14 started, where he said, "For a long time I've kept silent." And however far the preacher wants to reach for context, I mean, the whole Old Testament is yours. But if you start there in verse 14, just how, Genesis 3, you're right. How long has God been waiting? Well, then go to Genesis 1 for, for when God just, not just with his almighty power creates, but when God opens his mouth wide in order to speak, not just existence into otherwise nothingness, but light into darkness, to more than compensate, to reveal, to identify the things that are wrong, but certainly then to cure and to save. So, it is, I think, with those words, I will turn the darkness into light before them, make the rough places smooth. Those common words, I think, again from Isaiah 40, and or similar thoughts, I mean. And then, "These are the things that I will do." That's just a set apart clause like this. "These are the things that I will do." With that language, I think it would be possible to make very clear inferences to things that Jesus clearly did, to. So the walking up to the man in order to give him a new path forward, and not just in life, but for all eternity. I will not forsake them when the whole world of religious leaders especially are going to set aside other people and they would be lost in darkness. Jesus is the one who goes to them, and to give them something greater than just whatever this world condemns, but what he can now forgive and then now comfort them through, namely his himself. So there's some strong language there that goes beyond just God's creating providential power and giving sight to the blind or light to the darkness, but even a saving activity in Christ to compensate for the idolatrous heart that would otherwise be lost.
Right, so verse 16, kind of a key opening to the gospel. Aaron, your thoughts on the gospel from the text or context?
Yeah, just to springboard off of what Caleb was just saying, regarding verse 16, that last statement, "These are things I will do for them, and not forsake them." I'm paraphrasing. It caused me to think of 1 Thessalonians 5 at the end, where it talks about, "May the God of peace sanctify you through and through." And then the verse 24 says, "The one who calls you is faithful and he will do it." Right? And granted, it's not using the language of blindness and sight, but this idea again of when God commits himself to doing something, it happens, right? And there's no stopping it. So if you are blind, there is spiritual sight, right? It's not going to be stopped. And the verse 21, I really like the idea of for the sake of his own righteousness. And maybe there's a way to amplify the gospel by thinking of it in its opposite. So what if God had never, because he got sick and tired of the world, which we could understand, that he never made known his promise to save people. And he just decided to keep it a secret or perform it in a corner, in some far reach of the world and nobody ever knows about it. That wouldn't that be like one of the most unrighteous things he could do? Oh, I have salvation for you, but I'm not going to tell you about it, but here he is coming after sinful people for the benefit. Why? Because he is simply a God who is good and righteous and merciful. I think there's a way to read this in which it's the righteousness in which he gives to us, not his own righteousness that he wants us to live up to. Right? This isn't merely just a legalistic sense or a legal righteousness. And his word is great and glorious because it makes us, in the end, glorious. I like that idea of Ephesians 5, where the light not only illuminates our problem, but it actually causes us to be light.
Great. So some ideas there for preachers to explore gospel themes from these verses or related sections too. Yeah, and I think we've mentioned it. The account in John 9 offers opportunities to do that as well, connecting that with Jesus and his work. In a sense, and I think maybe I'm getting this from commentary on the propers too, but that last verse in the Gospel of the day is at John 9:39. Those who are blind will see, and those who see will become blind. I think you kind of see that in this section of Isaiah too. And who knows, maybe Jesus is even thinking of a section like this as he speaks those words in John 9, judgment on the blind and salvation for the blind, or judgment on those who think they have sight, and salvation for the blind. Neat angle to explore. Open it up to other thoughts for connecting these words to where your listeners are at, or kind of bringing it together in by way of illustration, application, or theme ideas. Any suggestions, Caleb?
One I thought of was just how in conversations with people over the years, when people go through their news feed or their social media feed, which is of course just totally 100% pure and good and true, right?
Course, course.
Yeah, of course, right. That people tend to think that they can see everything that's going on, and that everything that's going on, they now can determine what actually is true or not. When the whole joke, of course, as we get to learn more about what this thing called algorithms are, is that algorithms are not meant to feed us the things that are true and right and good. They're meant to feed us the things that we prefer, and have shown habitually that we want to see. And so I say that because I wonder if that's maybe both a double entendre in a way as an example, because it illustrates at least two things. One, the vehicle that we often use to determine the things that we see, we even lack the ability or the perspective, the lens to understand that that tool itself is making us more blind, and it's illustrating more blindness that we already have that we're predisposed with. So there's like a blindness on blindness. Whether or not a preacher wants to just come out and say it, maybe your people are due, maybe not. That's up to the preacher's discretion. But I think the inherent idea there is, and this is kind of a theme idea. It's seeing as a matter of perspective. You have to be able to be completely outside of whatever you're looking at in order to see whether or not you inside the example, the life, whatever's the situation, are seeing correctly. And we just can't do that in our world, and we actually don't demonstrate the opposite by the use of news feeds and social media feeds. We actually demonstrate that to the core. And so the idea of it being a matter of perspective, God in his wisdom has illustrated for us just how our blindness is not just an eyeball brain mechanism, but it even goes to the depravity of our own hearts. And the reason he tells us that, of course, is so that with that spiritual perspective that only the word can give us, he would then, of course, demonstrate that only he can fix from it. So I think I would maybe go that direction. I think there's a lot of examples that you could give in modern times, depending on what your people are probably leaning into, which tends to be something.
Good suggestion. Aaron, any thoughts for further illustrations or kind of bringing things together?
Yeah, here I was thinking about the allegory of the cave, and I think Caleb's analogy is way better than the
I
allegory
like
of
that
the cave.
allegory. That's a good idea.
That's kind of what I was thinking at first, but it was to the same point. Sometimes, like, you don't even know what your reality is if you're blind. And I'm not saying, like, you get so caught up in your little echo chamber, your own world of your own creating. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm doing great. You're almost numb to your own sinfulness in a certain way. And I think that using social media is a great analogy of that. So for me, it's like woodworking videos, I guess. So something like that.
That's what sucks you in.
That's my pet idol, I guess.
Tractor beam.
Which is also great, like instead of like I chop half of it for wood to work with, and then the other part of it I worship, apparently.
Right, right. Yeah, there's something in Isaiah about that too, but you're right.
I was thinking you could maybe just asking the question, can you see it? And mainly being the Lord's salvation. And you can kind of maybe play with this double effect that these words have. On the one hand, there's some real scary things when you have to reckon with the Lord's judgment. And so you could lead the listener to a place where, oh no, I can't see it because I'm like, I should be judged as blind and as one who is an idol worshiper. I should be the one who has my hind parts pushed backwards and be put to shame. But then the second half of it would be, well, no, we can because the Lord gives light to those who are in darkness. He gives sight to the blind for the sake of his own righteousness. He makes known his saving work. And he's coming to with destruction. The enemies of God in the work of salvation always have to be destroyed, but he ensures that we're not his enemies and he comes to rescue us. So, yeah, we can see it because the Lord has given us eyes with which we to see it. I have another one, but I don't know. I can save that for later.
Well, go ahead, Aaron. I think if you've got another suggestion, another angle.
Yeah, I was just thinking God lights illuminates. This is a pretty straightforward one, making the break at verse 17. So the first section would be God illuminates his servant's blindness. And then we would grapple with who are actually, we're not really cued in yet in that section on who are the blind people and who are the idolaters. You could easily say, well, the blind people are out there and the idolaters are out there, right? There's a reason I'm here at church. But then maybe just pause and just have people kind of ask some pointed questions and then move into 18 through 21, where you get a little bit more law, but it ends with his own righteousness. And I think in that section, you could pull in Isaiah 42. So I had God's light illuminates his servant's blindness, God's light illuminates his servant's righteousness. Meaning, and I had capital S servant in the second one.
Yeah. So pointing back to the earlier part of the chapter, as the servant comes because of the Lord's righteousness and his saving righteousness, right? Good. Any other ideas to share, Caleb?
The one, just to circle back to the idea before, I won't repeat it, but just if seeing is a matter of perspective, and then just maybe getting your listeners to see, wait, the things that I think I see or recognize, whether it's news or social media, what have you, are they actually it? Maybe a way to help people illustrate that or for themselves simply is just to say, in 5 years from now, if you were to record all the things that you think you're seeing as accurate and true, and if your 5 year from now self were to look back, do you think that your 5-year-old version of 5 years from now self would think that absolutely everything you see is accurate and on point? And raise your hand. And if you raise your hand, you're crazy. but the so the just to raise the question, like, are we sure we're seeing reality the way we are? So if it's a matter of perspective, then point part one would be it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time. And there's where I think in verses 14 to 17, again, that break could be there. This whole context could come to light as God holding back, but for what reason? You kind of get into some law gospel there just in that first section. And then part two could be, I think there's an opportunity for tying in the readings there too when we see the difference of what's truly missing in our own blindness to tie in the gospel too. Part two could be the right prescription and lens, or even just the right prescription, because you could be standing right there at the right place and right time, but it is the Lord who ultimately says it's my law that's good. It's for my own righteousness, and I'm the one who's going to do it. So there's maybe one idea. Another brief one, not to get too long here, but just that God prefers blind people. Like, and there it kind of plays on the whole, like, well, who are the blind people? And I think that could be the first part. And then ultimately the second, that's a little bit more of a law gospel, part A, part B, which I know is not typically ideal for the preacher, but I think in that without a two-part sermon, you could probably do that in a more story-like telling style, potentially.
Great. Yeah, I think that could work. Good. Well, anything further to share with preachers? If not, we've got a lot to consider as we look at this beautiful text. Preachers enjoy doing that and enjoy proclaiming God's saving righteousness to his people this week.